This is an interview with Helene Denny, who was with the American Red Cross in World War II. Helene?
Thank you, Rose. I would like to share with you some of the things that happened to me at that period of time in my life. Some were interesting, some were tragic. Believe it or not, the majority of it was hilarious. And I had a tremendous culture impact.
This experience started in 1941, I think you said.
I was a student nurse when we were giving aid to Britain, when Britain was standing alone against the Axis impact. And I had gotten myself engaged to a young British Marine. And I knew at that point in time he had been injured in the Pacific when Singapore fell. And I became an avid Anglophile, which was a case of practically treason. I come from a Scots-Irish-American. But it was a lovely time to be in New York. Let me just give you a little bit about New York before we go into my overseas duty room. This was the times of the bundles for Britain when everybody was working so hard to help the cause. And of course the USO was in full swing in New York, staged or canteen. And even though we were only a student nurse, was permitted out from 7 to 10 at night. We went out every single night dancing. I come from the generation of white gloves and the dance craze. And it was a marvelous time to be young. I finished my nurse's training in September 1942. I had married the prior in July. My husband had come to the United States being repatriated for head injuries to Great Britain. And after graduation in September, I took my state boards to become a registered professional nurse in October 2, 3, and 4. And at 19 years of age, sailed to North Africa on October 18, 1942.
That was exciting.
I was on the Old Hope. The first service I saw overseas was on
the Old Hope. That was the hospital ship?
Yes. And I was such a credit to them and such an asset. I'm the world's worst sailor. They sent me back to Great Britain, and they attached me to British Civil Defense. I arrived in time just to sit on my state board there, and I became an SRN, a state registered nurse in Great Britain. And they immediately sent me back to school in Edinburgh, and I studied midwifery at the University of Edinburgh in Triage. Celebrated my 20th birthday at this period of time, and as soon as I had furthered my education in Triage, I was assigned to a unit of mobile hospital and triage, mostly triage, being that I needed some experience in that area. And this was from the sink ports all the way down to Southampton. And most of the work I did was in that area of Great Britain. Several times our contingent was called up to London. I was called down to Plymouth at the terrible, horrible incendiary time that they had where Plymouth was practically destroyed. I was also in Portsmouth for their 18-day raid. And I continued. I'd never seen so many airplanes in my life.
I don't remember too much about that. Can you elaborate?
Yes, that was in just after 1943. In fact, it happened over the Christmas of 42. And before I went back to school, they sent me down there. That was my baptism of fire. And why I chose to learn triage, I felt my education here in America as a hospital nurse did not prepare me for the type of nursing that was needed there at that point in time. And it opened up a whole new world to me. I learned a tremendous amount. One of the most amazing things that happened, I think, happens, is that you can learn to tolerate anything. I had decided, I made a pact with myself, if I was going to be killed in one of these raids, I was going to be warm in bed, not in a cold, damp, miserable shelter. As a result, I was always in a problem with my superiors for not going to the shelters. I happened to be the only American with my contingent for almost 2 years. Most of us were quite a mixed bag. It was very interesting. I worked with Australians and Canadians and, of course, British personnel.
Well, who recruited International Red Cross?
The International Red Cross assigned people. from other other countries within the Red Cross.
Yes.
And you had a choice. I could have gone to Germany. They would have sent me to wherever I felt that I wanted to go. Needless to say, I chose Britain, hoping my husband would eventually come to Britain. It was very unique. Many of the Canadian nurses had the same type of training that I did, which was vastly different from how they trained abroad. We had to make an adjustment there, but being that I didn't work in hospitals, it really didn't make that much difference. What I learned there held me in stead for the rest of my career. I stayed in the emergency triage disaster type of nursing right to this day, right here in Pinellas County. Several very amusing things happened to me. I decided at that point in time, like most very young people, and somebody who had this terrible time in me, with a set of twins in Oxford, in England, at the Radcliffe Infirmary. And a very dear friend of mine was evacuated with her children and my babies. And I rejoined my contingent immediately. And when we invaded in 1944, I was transferred from British Civil Defense to the American Army. And for the whole period of the invasion, we were 24 hours adrift. We should have invaded on a Sunday, and we actually didn't go until the Monday. I was down on the docks in Portsmouth Dockyard. And originally, we were there for triage when they were bringing back the LSTs and the destroyer flotilla and practically anything that they were bringing back the wounded on. I continued working with the American Army right into the Graves detail. And when they, I guess it was D-Day plus nine, a friend of mine took me on an official airplane ride, and I went over the beaches. He showed me where all my work had been coming from the past many days. And you have to be very young to be able to assimilate such a thing. I don't think I could do that today.
Very hard, I think.
And I worked on the Capricorn here in Graves detail. And it was only 26 men, and it was just devastating. And it was, like everything else.
I think maybe, since this is for historical purposes, you might say more about the Capricorn incident.
Well, that will bring us 40 years later. Do you
well,
want
yes,
now?
But...
Fine. The Capricorn was an American Coast Guard cutter that had been into the Tampa Bay area for repairs and was returning to its base in Galveston, Texas. And the first night out, on a beautiful, clear moonlight night, going down the channel and had just gone under our very famous Skyway Bridge, it collided. It actually crawled up the side of a huge tanker, got itself impaled upon the anchor, and was capsized and tossed back and sank immediately. And everybody below deck was captured below deck and did drown. Only one body floated away. Everybody who was above deck was thrown clear, and there were survivors, which was brought to one of our local hospitals. Let me give you an interesting point of view what happened with that. This occurred in the middle of a channel, and it included three of our counties in the Tampa Bay area. On the north side of the county was Pinellas County, on the south side was Manatee, and Hillsborough, which is the city of Tampa, is located. Cuts right through what they call the shipping channel. And there was quite a controversy over whose territory all of this occurred in. And when the American Red Cross called us out the first night, the bodies were brought to Pinellas County, Fort DeSoto Park, and that's where we set up our first aid post, our graves details, and of course the police, and et cetera, all the other authorities involved in this. Coast Guard all had their stations there. Then when it was decided that this had happened in Hillsborough County, the Hillsborough Red Cross moved in.
Oh dear.
And Manatee County Police, and of course all of the Hillsborough people in Pinellas by this time, 24 hours later, had the Navy died with the U.S. Navy became involved in this because they sent their divers in for the rest of the purposes. I stayed down there a whole week. The rest of my contemporaries at Red Cross dealt with a lot of the military dependents who had come from New Orleans, from all parts of Texas, without waiting for any transportation. Some of them were absolutely destitute. One pregnant girl came on a bus with two infants and the Red Cross. And of course, I must admit, the personnel in our Coast Guard stations were just fabulous to these people, finding them accommodation.
But it was the condition of the bodies that reminded you of...
These were perfectly healthy, normal young men. What horrified me was the fact that 26 people upset me in comparison to the thousands I'd taken care of during the war. I was in one raid where we had over 1,500 people killed in 2 nights, and plus all the evacuation of the wounded. And I was taking this and I destroyed this. And of course, it was what I was there to do. I really didn't come to Florida to camp day for service. Check out their credentials, etc. Sympathize with the people who had never seen anything like this before. Some several war boys were very horribly affected by this.
Yes, when it gets close to home like that.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting point, when I first went overseas, Ruth, we were down in Camp Dix, a group that I was going overseas with. A lot of them had already met there as a staging area. Like everything the American Army was doing for security in those days, when we look back now, we get hysterical at it. In the middle of the night, they came in their 210 trucks, and we all thought we were going to go down to the piers in New York and go, oh, no way. They brought us up to Central Park South, to the Barbizon Plaza Hotel. And as a native New Yorker, I'd never even been in this very posh hotel, you know, it was way above what I'd been accustomed to. And we stayed there a full week. And again, in the middle of the night, they came and put us back in the same 210 truck.
And this was a treat for you prior to...
We were confined to the hotel. This was the security. We were confined to the hotel. We were confined to the rooms that we were stationed to. They brought our meals to the rooms and everything. You know. And this was all part of security. When they brought us to the piers, I'll never know how it happened. I did not cross the Atlantic in convoy. I was one of 10 nurses that was put upon the Swedish freighter. And the only thing in this little freighter was 10 Red Cross nurses, a load of bacon and airmail lettuce. And we went over South Atlantic. We did not go the North Atlantic route. And I did not know it until many years later that I crossed the Atlantic during the heaviest time of the submarine packs. They sunk more tonnage the month that I crossed the Atlantic than any other month.
That was in 1941?
October 1942.
42.
And it was my husband who pointed this out to me. I did not know that. As a naval personnel, he had all of this information in his fingertips. It was very interesting. The crew did not speak any English. The food was superb, as only Norwegian food could possibly be. And when we left, the captain gave us each a little personal gift. And they were the inevitable brown paper bags. And it contained soap and toilet tissue. Pots of 12 Modest for each of us.
A Swedish ditty bag.
Things that we never ever, and also we each had a dozen oranges. And that was from the cook. The cook gave us each a dozen oranges on the mission. I arrived in Liverpool in the middle of a raid, and nobody had told me that the Mersey docks rose and flowed with the tide. As a New Yorker, I was not prepared for that, but we had stationary piers. Everything fascinated me. I was so young.
Well, it fascinates me now, too. reminds me of a lot of things too.
Let me say something else about
1942. Those buzz bombs, the V.
That did not come until 44.
44.
That was another.
I'm very hazy on dates now.
Believe it or not, I had great admiration for the British people. I will clarify that statement if I may. For the British women, when I first went to Great Britain in 42, there were very few men there. The majority of their men were either in the Navy or in the Northern Desert. And it was the women who literally kept that island going, as though they were defeated and would never give in. There was absolutely no question about it. And they hadn't only taken over all the heavy munition and industries and that type of thing. The land army was in full swing when I arrived there. And between the Italian prisoners of war and the British girls, they were doing their best. They were growing Brussels sprouts in the cracks in the sidewalk, according to the GIs who came later. They were fantastic. And of course, I learned to admire these women. So one of the first places I was based in Portsmouth was a public school. And it was both our living quarters, the classroom, as well as our post, also based at this first aid station. It was the barrage rooms that were all over the larger cities in England in those days. And they were manned by young girls, most of them just out of high school. Their average age was 18 to 20. And they were usually, the commanding officer would be one male with all of these females. And fortunately, all of their school mistresses answered the call. And they put these young girls, practically everybody I met who was in any type of an administrative or supervisory post, had been a schoolmistress in charge of the girls. And it was just a carryover from their school days. They had no problem with these youngsters either. The other people I greatly admired, there were several first aid posts that we, when I was on my ambulance and we did triage, that we'd bring these people back to. And they would give them emergency treatment there and then put them on evacuation training. And sitting on top of these first aid posts and on top of all the buildings, and it's always the cathedrals, I remember, all of these youngsters, 16 to 18, doing fire watch with the older men. And it was usually they were doing with their grandfather or the old man next door. Like my driver, Ruth, was a young man who had been injured in the North African desert, and he had lost a leg. And he actually managed, when his stump was bothering him, he'd use his crutches, and he was
driving.
When we would go to an incident, it would usually be for a collapsed building, and they would be digging out people, or at the fireman, or somebody had been injured. For instance, one night we had to answer a call where an airplane came in and crashed into the fire department. And my driver was out of the ambulance, I swear, before he stopped. And he was halfway across the field on his one leg while I was trying to get both of mine organized. Fantastic individual. And he, as I say, he was quite a young man, but I was that much younger than he was that he didn't even consider me a contemporary. And he treated me as he probably did his younger sisters. And, you know, he used to say, if your mother knew what you were doing here. He made sure everybody used perfect language, and nobody was allowed to use anything blue. Treated, as
dear,
I say,
days,
he took very, very good care of me. And that situation lasted. He and I, he was my driver the whole time, until they assigned me to the Americans. And then I had an American Red Cross girl from the Bronx, New York. And I use the term girl loosely. She was a 40-year-old woman. You know, to my 22 at that point in time, she was ancient, older than God. And, it was a very, for me, it was emancipation from the way I had been brought up in New York. I had gone to all parochial schools. I was totally restricted. I remember, Ruth, in those days we had nice girls and the other kind.
Yes.
And you were.
And most of them were nice girls.
Yes, and very, very well cared for by everybody. May I give you an example of how well cared for we were in comparison
yes.
to what's happening today in our free and easy society? I was in high school when I first met the boy I eventually married, and he was a cadet in their Naval Academy of Osborne. And he came over with the king and queen in 39 as part of the goodly group of students that they sent over in those days. And where I went to school, we used to have these tea dances where we entertained not only these foreigners, but mostly students from other states, other countries, etc. And I had to go down to the Brooklyn Navy Yard where he had been billeted for this period of time. He was invited down for dinner. And of course, we wouldn't even attempt to give him directions to come to my mother's home. And I can still see my father taking out an envelope and writing the instructions for me how to get to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And my parents gave me, I'm ready for this, 30 cents, which was his coffee and my coffee. And I did fine. I took the bus to the subway. When I got off the subway, I was in an area of the city I'd never been before. And I had to wait for a trolley car. And when I got on the trolley car, the conductor looked me up and down, and I had on my white horsehair hat and my white gloves and my black and white spectators. Very grown up at 16 years of age.
Smartly dressed.
And he looked me up and down and he said, "And where do you think you're going, young woman?" And I ripped out my envelope and I said, "My daddy said." And this is, "All right, young lady, if that's what your father said to you, you're to sit right there and I'll tell you when to do up this trolley car." And I was fascinated. I realize now the area of Brooklyn I was going through was pre-revolutionary, and of course it was a very poor element at that point in time as far as living condition. Plus the depression did nothing to help this area along. When we got to the Sand Street Gate of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, very famous area, I'm told. The trolley car motorman said to me, "All right, young woman, you ought to go outside, you ought to go through the gates, and there's an American Marine on sentry duty. You want to stay right by him until you see the trolley car coming in the other direction to take you back to the subway." I thanked him very much, and I tripped out, and the trolley car stayed there until I went through the gate. And when I told the Marine on duty what I wanted, he sent for my husband. And so it shouldn't be a lost cause, Ruth. I stopped making time with the American Marine. When my young man finally joined us, and he took my arm to go through the gate, and I said, in all my innocence, "I can't go out there." He says, "What do you mean you can't go out there?" In this marvelous English word. I said, "The motorman on the trolley car said." I was to wait right here until I could see the trolley car.
And his was the voice of authority.
That's right. But never occurred to me to disobey an older individual. I had been so well trained. Behavior modification wasn't in my lexicon in those days. I can still see the two young Marines looking at each other over my head. And I can still, and I think this is what endeared me to this young Englishman. He says, "All right, my girl." He said, "If this is what you were told to do, and this is what your conscience dictates you should do, we will wait right here." And we didn't talk. He teased me about that right up until the day he died. He never could believe what the United States did to me after that, because they took me into a hangar and taught me to throw my voice. I was never allowed to raise my voice. And they gave us officer status, as you know, Ruth, and we had to work with people who we were told would not take orders from us simply because we were women. And that would be mostly our Southern boys here in America. And when I went overseas, they were contemplating already, you know, the GIs had landed in They landed in North Africa, but they weren't in Great Britain at that point in time, and didn't come for a good 18 months later. I understood later on why you had to be today what we call assertive. In those days, were aggressive, and I can turn it on and off. I know all the language, but I don't use it. I find I can express myself without it. But I can pull rank. They taught me well.
We've come a certain distance, maybe not a long, long way.
And I use the word trained. I was a trained nurse, and they trained me in triage. They trained me to be a midwife. They trained me in public health nursing because of all the shelter nursing we did during those years and working out in with the civilian populace after disasters. I wasn't educated until I returned to the States.
Advanced
education. I mean, my baccalaureate, my master's, and I'm working on my doctorate now for years. I always tell everybody, it's a good thing they train me first. They educate me first, and never to train. I'm too opinionated. I never had any problem anywhere I lived. I could live in the barracks. We used to be billeted on people. Some of my greatest friends today are the children. Most of the women I was billeted on have since died. But I keep in contact with their children. I go to Britain, I visit. The Qantas and huts were the damnedest things in the world to live in that I've ever come across. But I shall never really complain. I did complain. I was today what we call a burnout. I was experiencing this just before I had my children. And the British are fantastic. Their attitude is a change is as good as a rest. And they took me off my ambulance. Didn't send me away for a rest to any nice seaside resort. They put me on an evacuation train to Troon, Scotland. I have never complained to this day about anything. It was the coldest, most miserable. We had very little to work with. And oddly enough, the whole contingent on the plane were American servicemen that they were transporting up there who were not, had not as yet recuperated sufficiently to make the sea voyage. They would keep them up in Troon until they were in better health to make the sea voyage. When I finally, I went back down on a motor convoy through choice. I wasn't going to get back on that train if I could avoid it for anything. When we were up in Troon, I thought it was very interesting. It was in the middle of winter, and Troon, as you know, is where the St. Andrews Golf Course is located. And all over that fabulous golf course, they had either canvas tents or Nissan Quonson huts. The whole thing was it had been originally a staging area on the way over, and at this point in time, it was very, very medical evac hospital. And they still had latrines, and their idea of a latrine was a pit with canvas from your knees to your shoulders. And the coldest, rainiest, you name it, weather. How I don't have a bladder problem to this day because
you're a survivor.
One thing that I did get something out of that trip, the quartermaster's up there, they gave me a beautiful pair of brand new parachute boots up until when I'd been wearing boondoggers.
Yeah, I'm still going.
I'm rambling, Ruth, and you don't
want
rambling.
No, that's fine.
The reason I mentioned accommodations, it seems to be one.
Oh, well, yes, accommodations are interesting.
I more or less told you pretty well what I did over there.
Yes.
Did I expect this experience to prepare me for a career? I didn't even expect to live. Didn't think we'd ever get through some of those raids, but actually it did help me much later in life to this day. My pay, Ruth, was my husband's allotment pay that I was entitled to as a married to a British serviceman. I was a volunteer American Red Cross.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. Yes.
Well, for the duration, did that work for the duration?
No, I did draw will pay in the beginning. And my British husband objected to his working. I could volunteer. Do the same work. And it's true. With his income and everything found, as they used to say in those days, including my clothing. They put me into battle dress.
And, did you wear a British uniform?
No, we all wore battle dress. Everybody wore, you know, the Eisenhower jacket and everything. And I had my American flag on my sleeves. I did have my blues. I had dress blues that I used to wear on state occasions. But you know, when I was over there, we still dressed for dinner in the evening if we were going out. And of course, my husband's family lived this way. I remember my mother-in-law cutting up, I'm totally convinced it was her wedding dress, and made me a beautiful black lace blouse. And she had managed to get a black velvet piece of probably an old cloak somewhere and made me an evening skirt. I used to say back to London. I wore my nurse's cape over everything, or my greatcoat. I still have my student nurse's cape over the red lining, but I wouldn't part with it because it was pure flannel wool, so warm, held me in such good stead. It's a different world over there today, you know. You'd never believe that they had any of the conflict. I went all through the Netherlands and Belgium this past spring. And I went to some of the battlefields from World War I, which they have left as a memorial to the tremendous loss of life there. But there's nothing from World War II except very, very regimented American, British, and French cemeteries. There is no battlefields per se as there were in World War I.
I do wonder why that is.
It would have been the beaches. It would have been the beaches. When you fly over the beaches today in Normandy and up to Gold and Juno, which were the American, the British precipices that they had to scale, they're all seaside resorts again today. In fact, some of the bunkers that the Germans built in those days that weren't destroyed are summer cottages and things of that description. In Portsmouth, at Eastmead Barracks, the Royal Marine Barracks, where they had the little cockleshell kayaks that went into Cherbourg prior to the invasion, both to do survey work for the oncoming invasion, with the huge big Mulberry Harbor that they had, what to do a lot of sabotage to their shipping and what have you in Cherbourg Harbor. The installation where they trained the cockleshell heroes, as we call them, the Royal Marines who did this work. It is now a rose garden, and it's dedicated to children. And they built right over. You can go down where they built these things and see how they trained and everything. But the whole top of it is a park and a rose garden. And you can
lovely.
Oh, I constantly underestimate the English. They always do beautiful things like that. The Royal Marine, the barracks in Eastmead, Royal Marines, is no longer an active barracks. It is a museum and a hospital, a convalescent home for all soldiers and people. And they never waste a thing. What had been barracks for young men is now barracks for the elderly. They don't have the VA concept, as you know, like we do here. They have socialized medicine, maybe they need it.
Yes.
But it's amusing to go and see all these old men still in their Royal Marine uniforms. I'm so proud. And, they had another lovely thing that happened there. I used to love to watch it. And when it took a plane coming in, strafing to stop it, they used to march from the barracks down what we would call the main road to the docks to go on the transports to go overseas. And as they go, they would whistle. And of course, they had their full packs, and they were in all their various groups, divisions, brigades, what have you. And they would whistle as they left, and it's what we know as the Bridge of the River Kwai song, which they call Colonel Boogie.
Yeah, Colonel Boogie's March, I think, is the formal title, if I'm not mistaken.
I can remember standing with my pram my twins in the pram, and as soon as my little daughter would hear the whistle, she'd be jumping up and down the pram, rocking like crazy. And a German plane came in one day and strike. I don't know how many of the German men came out. So they, from then on in, they moved them out in trucks until after the war, and then they reverted back. It's beautiful. Let me tell you something else that happened to me that really doesn't Good. Have to do with World War II. We were posted to Bermuda after the war. I first joined him in Malta in time to get a telegram.
Was he in the United States?
He was a British Marine. He had served in the British Royal Marines.
But you met him?
In high school in New York City.
I see. Yes, I got a little mixed up.
And I went to Malta in time to repack and leave because he'd been reassigned from the Mediterranean Fleet to the Atlantic Fleet. So I went from Malta to Bermuda. But I stopped in New York on the way home to visit my family. And for 2 years in Bermuda, I was one of the three wives on the station. Our squadron was 42 ships.
What fun.
And three wives, the admiral's wife, the chaplains, and me. Needless to say, I was the only American. But I was always the only American wife of a British serviceman the whole 5 years I was in Bermuda. And we stayed there until I went to Korea. And while we were in Bermuda, there was a problem down in what was then British Guiana in South America. And of course the Britons, the British Navy was going to send down a cruiser with a contingent of Royal Marines aboard to show the flood and take care of what was ever happening down there. And I went down to the American consulate in Bermuda and told them I was an American, of course, nurse. I could not nurse in Bermuda. It was against their law. I was an American citizen. But I heard that they were having a big problem down in British Guiana. And I had all this expertise in triage and evacuation. And if there was anything I could do, and they notified Washington, D.C., and I found myself the next morning on a British overseas plane. And when my husband jumped into British Guiana, there I was on the jetty waving. I had taken all my, taken all my gear with me and everything. I did leave a message in Bermuda for them to signal my husband I was going. There was some mishap. It didn't arrive until after I did. That was the first time my husband really realized that from that point in, he had married today what we would call a woman who could definitely take care of herself. And he never worried about me. He never worried about me after that. I had older in the world. But he still had that very, very old-fashioned, and I use the term old-fashioned, Edwardian attitude that women must be protected.
And maybe you remember the little incident at Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Almost,
where you couldn't take a streetcar without a conductor.
Yes. It was very difficult to assert myself that I did not need this type of protection. The children need it. The animals need it. I was neither a child nor an animal.
Hardly.
By the way, the British, in 24 hours in Korea, when they made the decision to send a heavy cruiser, again, they pulled every Royal Marine off all the ships from all the various places down the Caribbean, all along the United States. In 24 hours, they sailed Korea. And I was left sitting on that hunk of coral with the children.
And you didn't go to Korea? Or?
I was pregnant by that time. No, I returned to the States in September of 1951.
You had a long stretch over there.
We thought that Korea was going to last 3 weeks. And we all know what happened there. Well, I did not. When I came home in 1952, I again went back and I worked at Mitchell Field in Roosevelt, Long Island, which was at that point in time an Air Force base. It had originally been an army air force base, but it was just air force. And the majority of the patients that they flew in, and by this time they were flying our boys across the United States from Korea to Guam, to Hawaii, to Travis in San Francisco, and then to as close to home as you can get them. And across the New York, Brooklyn Naval Hospital, New York Naval Hospital in St. Albans, and all the VA hospitals in the vicinity were taking care of Asian men as close to them as possible in the whole New York area. Mm-hmm. And I again did evacuation work there, which was interesting. I was back on my ambulance.
Yes.
What did I know?
Can't think of anything else. You've given us quite a few memorable experiences.
Did I experience conflict with being feminine in a military professional? I think in those days there was a tremendous demarcation of what was expected of us as women. One of the things that was drilled into me, even as a student nurse, as a professional woman, I was to be what they considered a lady at all times. Nothing less than it would be inexplicable behavior and dismissal. If I would do anything with them, any of it. I love the term shame. Isn't it? I wasn't intact to the GI Bill of Rights. As I mentioned to you before, the only thing they would have done was bury me. I love that. The greatest adjustment, believe it or not, was to the weather. I didn't mind that. As a student nurse, I was accustomed to uniforms and everything. Like all people in those trying times in Great Britain, I was hungry. I was always hungry. I was young enough to have the appetite of a teenager.
Yes.
And then between that and my pregnancy, I was the rations were appalling in Great Britain.
Were you dependent then on British rations?
Yes.
Yes. Well, yes, at the beginning you would have been.
Yes, totally. I didn't have it made until my own uncle came over. My father's youngest brother came over with the American forces in 1944. And from then on in between, my Red Cross packages for expectant mothers, new mothers, or again expectant mothers, and this connection with the American services, I was all right. But up until then, I was just plain hungry. And it's not that there wasn't sufficient to eat, it was a monotony. Although there are several things that I really like, for instance, I still enjoy Brussels sprouts. Most people I know who are over there don't even look at them. And lamb. I enjoy the lamb. And when I see the price of lamb today in the stores, have you any idea what the rations were for a civilian at that point in time in Great Britain?
Not in Britain, no. I know that they had rationing well after the war, too.
Yes, it extended right into the 50s. When I first was assigned, being that I was with a mobile contingent and a nurse, I had the privilege of going into any nurse's home for any meal, and they were compelled to feed us. We did not have to give up any of our rations, any of our
points. I hope they didn't resent this. I don't imagine.
Sometimes they weren't prepared for it, and they would have to shortchange other people who needed it. But they were always good for a cup of cocoa, a cup of, in fact, every time I stepped off my ambulance, somebody was there putting a mug of tea in my hand. When I was expecting my children, I was entitled to a ration and a half. And my ration as an adult was two slices of bacon and a chop a week. 2 ounces of tea, 2 ounces of sugar, 2 ounces of butter, 4 ounces of margarine, and 20 points a month, which went for like cookies, biscuits, and canned food. And for instance, tin of peaches with 16 points, so I only have 4 points. Cookies, my downfall as an American. Biscuits. I could only get perhaps a quarter of a pound if I wanted both a tin of fruit and biscuits. I usually gave up the tin of fruit and got all biscuits if I could. You ate everything in season. For instance, when apples were in season, we had apples morning, noon, and night. Cooked, uncooked, raw, everywhere in the world. I never saw a banana. I didn't see eggs until the Americans became involved, and I started seeing the great and glorious powdered egg.
Yes.
Of the fond remembrance. I can remember one year the daffodils were growing wild all over the place, and the Italian prisoners of war were bringing them in and giving them away. Another thing that they did that I was very impressed with, they had leave and no place to go, no money, nothing to do, and they had all these flowers from the country where they came from. I remember this particular train came in from the wine region. And they went to the cemetery and laid flowers on their graves.
The Italian prisoners.
Prisoners of war. It must have been some Italian Remembrance Day or something.
Yes.
I was on a train leaving. I was going to another post. And it's another thing. Sometimes we went in convoys. Sometimes we broke up into groups. And we were our usual standbys, you know, first call, second call, third call, whatever his name. We were capable of either servicing a 475-bedded hospital, an evacuation train. They trained you for a certain amount of evacuation train, but that was a fallacy. You just packed as many people and children in as you possibly could. My ambulance was supposed to carry 6 stretcher cases. Well, we would have 12 stretcher cases and 10 standees if necessary. And I'd be carrying babies on my back. They taught me how to sling babies in harnesses. Babies were for free then, Ruth. You found a child and it couldn't be identified. Nobody wanted it. If you wanted it, you just have to go down and apply for all the social services for it. And they'd be glad to let you adopt that infant. One of the things they did was to keep everything as much with the civilians in the civilian capacity, even though the whole country was under martial law. I keep digressing into other areas, but keep going back to the war.
This concludes the interview with Helene Denny by Ruth Benonis. Unfortunately, the background noise was unavoidable.